Welcome, Patreons, to part two of episode 10, Don't Talk About Politics with Sarah Stein Lubrano. I'm really grateful for your support, and I hope this project brings some joy, hope, and utility to your ears and to your works and days. In part one of my discussion with Sarah Stein Lubrano, we explored her central argument from Don't Talk About Politics, which is that debate, podcasts, and rational, persuasive techniques rarely change anyone's core political beliefs. She was talking about the fact that while people certainly learn information from political media, including things like this podcast, learning is just not the same as transformation. Political commitments are rooted in identity, belonging, and social networks. And without altering the material fabric of life, new arguments might just bounce off a person like rain off of a raincoat. Now, Lubrano says that meaningful political change tends to arise from two forces, relationships on one hand and lived experience on the other. When people join mutual food efforts, when they volunteer at food banks, when they work alongside others, when they enter new communities, their sense of the world can shift. So instead of telling someone to think differently or debating them until they relent, we could invite them to live differently. And that would be something that might actually even be anti-fascist. We also talked about something a little vulnerable for me, given my past years working on critical thinking in a number of my endeavors, and how this often operates as a class-coded ideal shaped by academic habits, independent analysis, essays, debate, you know, what you do in college, what you do in high school even. Lubrano emphasized that political consciousness historically developed through action, shared struggle, and friendship, not solitary intellectual work. To truly change someone's political orientation, they needed not only information, but a new world to step into. That's what we need if we're going to change the way we see things. Now, Lubrano draws on cognitive dissonance and system justification theory to explain why people sometimes defend systems that oppress them, and how abandoning those beliefs without a replacement community can be really psychologically destabilizing. And we, of course, connected this to cult dynamics, how people rarely leave until they have somewhere else to go, even if they're in a terrible situation. Political transformation, like exit from a cult, requires a kind of off-ramp, and more importantly, a landing place, a social landing place. So here's part two. We're picking it up from a discussion of what really changes our minds if it's not book learning, if it's not middle-class university essay writing. What really radicalizes us?
I mean, when I think about, and I tell this to the people in the movement school all the time, like, when did you really change your mind on something? I will tell you when I changed my mind on things. Okay, number one thing, one of my students was raped. And then the police also got involved and they were not very helpful. That was bad. That changed my mind about a lot of things. What else happened? I taught in prisons and I met the people in prisons and I said, oh, wow, these women, A, firstly, they're here a lot because of their boyfriends, and B, they can't read. That changed my mind a lot, right?
Right.
I mean, I could go on and on, but I don't think any amount of abstract knowledge would have made me truly more interested and passionate about pulling apart the system at its roots, because I was doing fine. I was at a fancy university having a perfectly nice time.
Yeah.
No, I needed something else. I needed to really see that something was rotten at the core. And a lot of people need that experience, and that's fine. That's how we learn.
Well, for me, I'll just say that the most radicalizing thing that happened was becoming the parent of an autistic kid whose brilliance and challenges really kind of put into stark perspective who the world is made for and who is excluded from it, and what people who are neurotypical are generally trying to enforce with regard to the standards of, you know, social production and, you know, capitalist adventurism, right? So there is nothing more radicalizing than just the day-to-day, oh, this is what we have to do, or this is how we have to learn something in a new way, or this is how my own understanding of how time and accomplishment and learning and creativity is going to unfold, and it's not going to be according to, you know, the benchmarks that have been set forth by public schooling, for example.
Yeah. And you know what? I honestly think this is fine. Like, one of the things that I want to say over and over again when people, sometimes people will come to me and they'll say, but this sounds really hard and it sounds like I'm gonna have to do a lot of stuff that doesn't involve like any amount of writing, or like, yeah, that's right. You're gonna have to go in the world and you're gonna have to use a set of skills that you were not taught in school that are about everything from talking to people different than yourself to doing a bunch of labor with your hands, right?
Right.
And, or having feelings. Like, if, like, you know, I don't want to tell you about parenting because you are a parent and I'm not a parent, but a lot of parenting is not, there is an intellectual element to parenting, certainly, and there should be, but there is also a lot that is like affective.
Oh, right? Yeah.
It's about love.
Right.
It's about love and it's about labor and it's about getting up at 3 a.m. over and over again, yeah, for someone who is not grateful because they are too busy being 2 years old, and on and on and on. And yeah, and you know, I was not a neurotypical kid either, certainly. And I had no idea what my parents were doing for me. And they did a good job, I will say this. You know, my parents and I obviously have our issues sometimes because that's family life. But
right,
they did a pretty good job, actually, with this bit especially. And in any case, the point is, it required a set of skills that are somewhat cognitive and somewhat intellectual, but also embodied. And those are the same skills, interestingly, that we need a lot of the time for political change, because they are about loving people and adjusting to them and trying things out and bringing people along on the journey and remaining motivated and doing physical labor and getting up early and, you know, whatever other horrible hard things that are also super meaningful. And I think that's thinking too. Like, that is thinking about politics correctly.
I want to do two major sort of centerpiece ideas in your book before I round down my questions, because I think they're super important and they involve your framework for the marketplace of ideas, not actually encouraging people to try new things. And then also your criticism of reasoning as warfare, in which I think you're implying that like the Jubilee series on YouTube doesn't really work.
Yeah, well, I actually, if you want to start with that first, I've just wrote an essay for Zateo, so it will come out on Medihassan's network about why it doesn't work.
Because, yeah. And are you going to like, are you addressing it to him? Because of course he just sort of, I think, had a big learning curve on that show.
He had big learning curve, but I think not, you know, smart learning curve. I want
to
give.
He didn't seem to be aware, according to his own account, of what exactly the setup was before he entered that arena.
Yeah. Well, he was essentially scammed, right? Because he was not discussing anything with Trump supporters as such. He was discussing things with like very hard right, far right people that are already quite experienced also on being on platforms. It's not like they missold him the experience. But the other point I want to make, which is slightly different, lots of people have correctly and importantly pointed out that you never debate fascists because then you platform them, blah, 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 whatever. That's all true, all important. But I think the other thing that's worth saying is, even if these people weren't fascists, this may not be the right use of our time.
Right.
Because debate is great entertainment, but it does not change people's minds. There's a lot of data. One of the things I go into very early on in my book is just a bunch of data on whether people who watch televised debates, whether they are decided or undecided on the issue or the vote, change their voting intention afterward. And I know that everyone will immediately be thinking, oh my gosh, but like, what about Kennedy versus Nixon? What about Biden?
Exactly, right.
Right? Cool. I find that weird also, but actually when people do meta-analyses, so when they look at, you know, okay, let's put all of the debates we can find data on in multiple countries around the world over the last 50 or 60 years and see if we can even see meaningful shifts after a debate, the answer is no, which means that when you see a result after a debate, it's basically a random statistical walk.
But it also becomes very, very attractive to the person who believes that, yes, this is how we change minds. Like, it's almost, if we have a Kennedy and Nixon moment, or if we have Biden and Trump, we can really fixate on those moments as kind of like, oh, the gladiatorial system, it actually worked, and let's see how we can make it work again.
So I think, firstly, you're right. The people don't want to accept that statistical analysis, because if they see even a tiny move, they're like, wow, I did such a cool thing. Yay, I feel so powerful because I too can debate, right? There's a kind of interesting false agency there. But I think the other thing that's worth saying is we have to really follow that logic all the way down the rabbit hole for a second. Imagine if it were true that as long as there's been a debate, whatever the outcome is probably good because the best ideas will always win in a debate. Where are we now? Do we think the ideas that are currently in power in, I don't know, the states, are the best ideas? Did they win because we debated them in a marketplace of ideas and the best ideas won to the top? And the best idea is that we have like military control over Washington, D.C. at its lowest point of crime in 20 years? I mean, come on. Like, I just think it's almost preposterous on the surface of it, which is sometimes how you know that you're deep in ideology, right?
Now, that particular logic flow, I haven't heard it before, but it seems irrefutable. And is anybody else saying that? Is anybody else saying, oh, wait a minute. Doesn't the marketplace sort of idea, doesn't it sort of guarantee that what we have is the best we could possibly have?
Well, look, most of the ideology doesn't surface as hardcore singular claims. Sometimes it does, right? But it often doesn't. I will say to you that as a person who suddenly gained like 12,000 Instagram followers in the last 2 months, I do get this. Like, I do get people who see my videos, then aren't triggered, and then write me long essays about how I must be wrong and debate is actually the perfect epitome of democracy and blah, blah, blah. I get those people.
Right.
But I think that the more important question is about why all of us are a little bit anxious about the idea that debate doesn't work. I find even I'm still anxious and I wrote this book, right? And part of that is because it's not just that we all explicitly hold this belief, because some of us don't and some of us are ambivalent or whatever. It's baked into all of our institutions. What do you learn when you go to school to write an essay in America? You basically learn to debate on a piece of paper, right? And then how does our legal system work? People debate each other. How does our parliamentary system work in the UK? People debate each other. How do presidential things work? People debate each other. How does Congress work? People debate each other, right? I mean, it's baked into absolutely everything. I mean, it's baked into the dinner table now, right? And so even if people are not explicitly making that argument, many of us are conforming to it all the time. At the end of the book, I talk about this again, and I give the example, obviously unrelated in a direct sense, of beauty culture, of the idea that there are many women, including myself in this world, and men, who, of course, would explicitly say, like, no one owes anyone pretty, you know, expectations of a specific kind of beauty are oppressive and bad. And then they will go and they will put on their makeup and they will go to the gym and they will shave and they will whatever, right? And I'm not saying those people are bad or wrong, by the way. I think it's actually a really complicated question what you do in a world that still massively rewards people to a degree for certain kinds of physical beauty. But the point is that that's how ideology works. It's not just about your explicitly stated beliefs. It's about how does the system work? What does it reward? How do you get that so embodied in the way that you think and do day to day that you almost can't get out of it? I mean, I find myself wanting to get into the Instagram comments with people and debate them because I think, no, I have the data, look at the data. And I, you know, you have to kind of like always be deprogramming yourself from ideology. And this is a piece of liberal ideology, right? It's still not a fascist ideology. I would not say the desire to find justice through debate, it's not inherently fascist, but it's getting in our way.
Going back to Sartre, they're not actually interested in
they don't give a shit.
You know, the mechanics of debate. No. They want to dominate through words that they don't actually believe in, and so and maybe that's the primary liberal mistake, is to sort of not recognize the point at which I'm trying to speak sense here, and the person I'm, you know, discussing things with, they're laughing at that whole idea.
Yeah, I think it's the secondary liberal mistake, because I think the number one liberal mistake, Matthew, is, sorry, sounds, you know, persuaded myself so well, but like, it is actually not even to do with the fascists. It's to do with the fact that if you want, like, we would never say, and you know this because you just talked about your kid, we would never say that to do family life well is primarily to tell people the right words.
Right.
We would never say that. To be a good family member or a good friend or a good comrade or a good anything is to also do the actions. And frankly, why would anyone care what you think or what words you have to say if you're not doing something for them, if you're not profoundly with your actions invested in their well-being, right?
Yeah.
And so the liberal, I mean, it's much worse once we get to fascists. Of course it is. And this is a podcast about anti-fascism. So great, let's talk about it. But the number one problem is you should be doing something for this person long before politics comes up. You know, you should be invested in their well-being. And that's why I talk about food co-ops in the book. And that's why I talk about mutual aid. And that's why I talk about, you know, it's people's actions and their relationships first. And all the words downstream of that. And, you know, if they come beforehand, they're useless in a way. Because that's not how human beings are set up to care about or entertain ideas. We entertain ideas by doing them and noticing that other people care about us.
We're in an age of protest. Mm. And you argue that protest works as a process, as a horizontal process, as much as a zero-sum game of achieving the protest goal. So, you know, I guess the question is, why protest if it's unlikely that the protest itself will change the opinions of those who view it from the outside or will change a policy or outcome?
Like, why should we protest?
Yeah.
Yes. So let me just review what I say. So what I say, and it's not just what I say, it's like what a huge swath of data says. When we look at protests, the question is, what is the protest for? And let's think for a minute about protest in a narrower sense, which is demonstration. Because you could argue that like blocking roads is protest, and it is, but then there's kind of like you can screw up. It's a different format of protest because it's holding something hostage that the state or a corporation wants until they give you what you want, right? That's
right. A different mechanism. Direct action.
It's direct action, yeah. But and by the way, direct action is also having a bad time lately, but that's another story. But if we're just thinking about it as a form of discourse, really, right, where you get on the street and you make demands and you like show there are a lot of people there and they all believe the same thing or similar and they have their signs, right? That as a form of discourse. People might say, okay, well, the protest works because it changes the government's mind. Maybe it intimidates them because they just see a lot of people believe this, right? Or they would say it's good because it changes the public's mind, because the public sees these signs, then they entertain the ideas, and then their minds are changed.
Right.
These are both wonderful theories, and the unfortunate matter is just that there is not good evidence for them, either of them. There's a lot of evidence that protest movements do not change the public's mind, especially in the long term, and they don't change the government's mind, maybe even more so. The closest thing we have to an example of a protest movement that changed people's minds for a bit is Black Lives Matter, but that really lasted for about 4 or 5 years. We're now back to the same baseline beliefs that we had before that movement. And that's very common for protest movements, actually. They might very briefly switch people's views a little bit, and then people go back to their baseline view. And that's pretty typical. Similarly, governments are not particularly inspired to respond to protests, especially now, because protest movements are often basically upswells of excitement on social media that recede within a week or two. But also, governments are doing the policies they're doing anyway for the reasons they're doing them, often for the interests of like the top 10% of earners who are their donors, right? And unless there's something really important in the way that forces them not to do the thing that is otherwise strategically best for them, why would they care what a bunch of people in the street are saying, especially if those people wouldn't vote for them anyway? It's like George W. Bush always said about the Iraq War protests, that listening to them would be like, you know, deciding foreign policy based on a focus group. And this was a focus group of people he already didn't like who would never vote for him anyway. So then that suggests that protests, just like debate, doesn't change minds exactly, right, for most groups of people. But there is one group of people who does change their mind, and that's the protesters.
Right.
People who join protest movements in the long run, they are changed in a lot of ways. They're changed quite profoundly, actually. When I list this series of effects, people often groan in the audience. But, you know, people who join protest movements compared to other people who had the same set of beliefs before him but don't join those movements in similar demographic situations, the people who actually join the movements become more likely to get divorced. They become less likely to be parents. They become more likely to go back to graduate school, which is a terrible idea. They, you know, they become more likely to work for low-paid jobs in the public interest. I mean, they really shift a lot as human beings, and they also hold on to different political beliefs than people who didn't join that social movement.
Right.
They are changed for good, which is actually kind of beautiful if you think about it, right?
Right.
But that also points to the fact that if our theory of change is that people make a lot of noise in the street, that is probably a poor theory of change. If we think, however, that protests are a way that we recruit people into long-form relationship with the social movement for the rest of their lives, and then those people go and create new experiences in the community for everyone, and they build relationships that people didn't have before, that might be a workable theory of change.
You know, I just interviewed the other day a woman named Sarah Rasik, who is one of the primary spokespeople for the Occupy for Palestine encampment at the University of Toronto. And she's a graduate student in social justice ethics. And she described exactly this, that even though the encampment was eventually dismantled, they did that in advance of the court injunction and in advance of any kind of police intervention, the actual experience, the interpersonal experience, was transformative for everybody involved. They were doing potluck dinners every night. The aunties were showing up with the, you know, minivans full of, you know, food. They were doing, you know, Seder and Passover meals. They were doing all kinds of prayer rituals and teach-ins and things like that. And the actual outcome of the, you know, stated strategy for the encampment didn't exactly turn out the way they would have wanted to. And of course, the disaster is ongoing. At the same time, I was hearing a very clear sort of account of a movement becoming long-term and becoming intergenerational.
Yeah, the point is the protesters, they get changed for life, right? And so, but I think the important thing here is essentially that you have a strategy that includes that as part of your analysis. Because a lot of movements have failed precisely because they haven't done this, right? So the best strategy, I would argue, for a group like this is to say, great, do we have everyone's email that was in the encampment? What are we asking them to do now? What do they need? I mean, a lot of the point of social movements is actually that they hold the activists tightly enough that they're okay.
Right.
Which is especially hard now because we're living under increasingly authoritarian governments who are especially hostile to Palestine supporters. So the question is, you know, how much is that figured into what you're going to do? But yes, people are changed for life. And that's beautiful, because the truth is, I don't know about you, but I'm certainly have an optimism of the will. I honestly wake up every day being pretty happy, unless, I don't know, one of my lovers is mad at me or something. You know, I'm pretty happy in my life. But I'm not an optimist about what I will see before I die. Like, I don't think we're going to have a nice century. We're going to have a really tough century in a broad sense, in terms of the progress, in quotes, that we might make against fascism and climate problems and other stuff. And yet, I'm an optimist about what those of us involved in the struggle can do for each other. I think we can have really good lives, because I think we can make the definition of a good life about, like, taking care of each other and understanding the world better together and knowing that another world is possible, right? I mean, I think this is what we have. We don't have the assurance of winning. And in fact, I think for now we have the assurance of losing for a long time.
Right.
But we have the assurance of building a different world between ourselves. We can do that any day. They cannot stop us. They really cannot. And I'm up for that.
You know, that was maybe the answer to my last question. Maybe you want to add something to this, because what I've got down here is, what would you tell the 15-year-old about how to enter the practice of don't talk about politics?
One of the things I say in the book is that the person who does politics well is in many ways not that far away from the person who is a good friend. And this is a very old idea held by very unfashionable people like Aristotle, right? You know, I mean, it's not like I'm coining this idea from scratch, and all good ideas are recycled anyway, in my opinion. And Aristotle thought we should own slaves, so neither should we worship him. But the point is that some of the virtues involved in politics are the same as the virtues involved in friendship, right? If you want to use a virtue framework, you can use anything you want, really, to get to the same point. But a good friend is not a good friend because they are, like, really sharp with their arguments.
Right.
Maybe that's fun to have in a friend, maybe. But, you know, we don't need it. They're a good friend because they listen to us, because they are involved in a non-transactional relationship with us that can stand the test of time, because they're there when things get hard, because they're there when things are easy, because they're full of joy in a certain sense. Or if they're not, then they can, like, live through the sadness together, right? I mean, it's like, kind of a beautiful, profound question of the good life, which might sound really out of place when we should be talking, I don't know, about, like, I don't know, the superstructure or something. But actually, I think that's the level at which you get through struggle for the rest of your life, at the level of friendship. And the good news, you know, I feel like I'm a Christian missionary here. The good news is that people who are involved in long-term struggles like that are happier than people who have the same beliefs but are not. And also that people who have good friendships are happier than people who don't. And we basically have to commit to both those things. And then lots of other things seem not to matter very much at all. So if you have good relationships with people, the amount of money you make, not that important. Am I sad for the people that join a protest movement and earn less money? No, they're doing great. They are genuinely happier and better off according to every metric they give us and anything we could measure from the outside. It is a good trade. It is good heart. And I'm really interested in that good heart. So what I would tell the 15-year-old is, go and learn how to be a really good friend. And then go and find a part of the world that is broken that you want to fix, and know that you're going to spend the rest of your life doing that, and that is a great use for your human life, and do it joyfully. I mean, not every moment of it is going to be joyful. If you're dealing with something like Palestine, I mean, you know, it's not a joyful thing in many aspects of it. Of course, it couldn't be, but I don't know. Something that I've really come to in the last few years, based both on this research and just on being a human being in this world, is that if you cannot make it joyful and sometimes even fun, you are going to burn out. And so I think the joy is really, really important. I used to think this was a frivolous, stupid idea that, like, only hippies that wore, you know, I don't know, paisley pants thought. But I actually think it's true for all of us. We are going to have to make it fun so we can keep doing it. And that's what I say to the 15-year-old. Go have fun. Go learn to be a good friend. Find something that's broken that gets you up every single morning because you care about it that much. And you will, you know, in a certain sense, never work a day in your life, but in a very different way than the capitalist motto says.
Sarah, thank you so much for your time. It's a great book. I hope that a lot of people get to know it. And thank you so much for your work.
Thank you so much for having me on. It was a pleasure.
So I want to close with just a little anecdote about meeting my episode 9 guest, Sarah Rose Kaplan, in person the day before that episode came out. Now, most of my writing life is in solitude, and a lot of the closest professional connections I have are online. And often there are thousands of physical miles between us. Like, I've worked with my colleague Derek Barris on Conspirituality Podcast for going on 6 years now. I've never met him in person, which seems very strange and a little bit haunting, because our relationship is close enough that every once in a while I'll get this premonition that he's vulnerable or something. He's riding his bike and maybe he's got a flat tire. Maybe he crashed, or he's a cancer survivor. Maybe his cancer comes back. Now, this is never true. I don't have any sort of clairvoyance, or I don't even believe in that, but I think what my brain is doing is it's trying to make contact with someone that I should be in contact with in a different way. Maybe I'm trying to envision the circumstances in which I would have to make this decision that, oh, I'm going to fly to Portland tomorrow to visit and hug my friend. Derek, if you're listening to this, this is not a death wish on you, I promise. I just think it's an unconscious way of asking, why can't I reach out and touch this guy on the shoulder? Like, I'm so close to him, and yet there's so much distance. And so this is a long way of saying it's rare that I get to meet my online people. So I get to meet Sarah, and it was great to hang out and have some Ethiopian food and to realize that, oh yeah, I do feel relaxed around this person. Like, it wasn't an illusion. They are who I expected them to be. And we had a nice time. But here's the story. We're the only folks in the restaurant, one table on the go. Sarah's just been telling me about how improv music and comedy has always been a kind of lifeline for her sense of social trust. It's always helped her overcome hesitation and reticence. And one of her favorite things is to improvise Broadway-style musicals in this troupe that she hangs out with. So someone in the crowd calls out a random topic for a musical, and then the piano person just starts playing. And as soon as the piano is 4 bars in, Sarah knows she just has to jump in and sing. So she finishes the story and we're about to pay. And then these 3 kids walk into the restaurant and we hear them tell the host that they're hungry and they ask for bread. And the host kind of looks them over and nods and goes back to the kitchen. And so we think that she's going to bring some bread back out. And Sarah asks them if they're okay, and they repeat, they're hungry, they're not close to home. And I asked, do you live in Toronto, guys? And they kind of hemmed and hawed, and they weren't clear. So Sarah said, if you wait for a few minutes, I can take you to get burgers or something. So they had been outside, and they were shivering from the cold. They weren't fully winter dressed, but the clothes they did have were okay, and they didn't look uncared for. And so I wondered if they were staying at a shelter nearby and had access to clothes and showers. I thought they were white kids at first, but possibly they were First Nations kids as well. Maybe they had come from up north, but I didn't ask any other questions. Then the host comes back with a full plate of Ethiopian food on that flat spongy bread injera. But the kids, of course, had been gearing up for Sarah's burgers or whatever they were going to go out and find. I don't think they'd ever seen Ethiopian food before, and it looked like they were going to turn their noses up at it, especially the salad part. And at this point, I had to get going. So I was putting on my coat and, you know, starting to say goodbye. And when I went to give Sarah a hug, I said, this is kind of like your improv life, this spontaneous intervention, like, you don't know what's going to come of it. And she said, yeah, that's for sure. And as I left, I heard Sarah encouraging these kids to just try the food so as not to be rude to the good women who had offered it to them. And so the next day, I followed up with Sarah online, and she said that they did eat enough to thank the women, and then they were really happy to go out and get some burgers afterwards on Sarah's dime. So it all worked out. And so she writes in the DM, they were very nice, these kids, and they seemed to take it to heart when I told them that the best way they could make it up to me was to buy food for some other hungry kids once they were adults with a bit of expendable money. And as I thought more about this, it just got deeper, because Sarah's here in Toronto because the U.S. is increasingly unsafe for her as a trans person, or that's a big reason. And there she is, improvising with hungry kids and actually taking a chance that there are no bigots around to accuse her of something weird. And I saw the moment where she started, and it was like hearing the four bars of music, I think, because she didn't hesitate. Even though there were like a lot of questions you could have asked about these kids, I had to get home to my own kids, but she had the time, and the improv god gave her a scene and she jumped into it. And three kids with stories we do not know, who were lonely in the cold, got some sense of warmth from these adults who themselves were so far from home. And that made me think of the other Sarah's dictum, the Sarah from this episode, how Lubrano says that it is the experience of new social moments that can change people's lives. And I just got to watch that happen, maybe. Thanks for listening, everybody. Take care of each other.